Hi, everybody, and welcome to Context Countdown. I'm Andrew Kurupko, and I'll be going over five recent news stories that need to be placed in context. Some of them are misleading, while others are spot on. But either way, there's a context behind them, and I'm here to tell you what's really going on. Let's take a look at our top five countdown for the week. At number five, we have Prime Minister Modi's landmark visit to Bangladesh, where he signed an agreement that finally ended a 40-year-long border dispute that stood in the way of closer relations. So what happened here, to give you guys a background, is that India, back in 1971, helped create Bangladesh by supporting it in its war of independence against Pakistan. At the time, Bangladesh was called East Pakistan. Well, what had happened is relations eventually cooled after independence, and they'd been obstructed by this border issue. Also, there were some differing Cold War alliances that were at play here. This border in question is over 4,000 kilometers long, and there's millions, tens of millions of people on both sides. Bangladesh itself has about 147 million people. But the problem is that there are enclaves on both sides. These are little small administrative islands inside the other. So some Indian territory inside Bangladesh and Bengali territory inside India. In total, it affected about 50,000 people. Well, Bangladesh wanted to resolve the issue 40 years ago, but India only recently ratified this agreement. And the question is, why? Well, there's two reasons, guys. The first thing is that India's partaking in a so-called Act East policy, and this is the successor to Look East. Basically, it says India wants to be a stronger actor in Southeast Asia and South Asia. So in order to do this, it needs to secure ties with Bangladesh to help create this bridgehead into ASEAN, into Myanmar, into the other countries in the region. Also, it facilitates India's pivot to the east, and India has long-term plans of creating a highway through the ASEAN countries. Second thing is China. China has this policy that some have referred to as a string of pearls, which are strategic naval outposts in the Indian Ocean. Also, there are fears that Bangladesh and China have been getting too close, and that by resolving the Bengali issue, India can increase its influence in the country. Also, there are millions of Bengalis in Northeast India and West Bengal State, and some of them happen to be illegal immigrants. So, by having good ties with the Bengali state, it would be able to keep things more stable, because if the government is on the side of the Indian government, then there won't be any fears of ethnic separatism or any other problems like that. But what is one of the most important things that happened is a coastal shipping agreement, which basically says that direct shipping between both states is not allowed. So what this means is that India can use Bangladesh to access the vulnerable northeast provinces that are out in the periphery. And by doing this, it can more closely integrate itself with Bangladesh, but most importantly, solidify its sphere of influence in South Asia and achieve a more tighter hold onto Northeast India, which I'll be describing in a later section, because actually a terrorist attack just happened there and there's a lot of dynamic situations going on there right now. The next one up is Nigerian President Muhammadu Buhari's new strategy for fighting Boko Haram, which he's in break with his predecessor by actively working with regional states and asking the G7 for assistance. Well, Mr. Buhari was just sworn in very recently as the official leader of Nigeria after winning the election that we spoke about before in a previous episode. And fighting Boko Haram has been one of his main campaign promises. Well, the first international trips he made were to Niger in the north and Chad to the east. And these are two of Nigeria's anti-Boko Haram allies. Well, he received some flack for these visits because some critics said they were degrading because the previous president had to resort to these international interventions to try to help the country regain its sovereignty in northeastern Nigeria. And that because Niger and Chad were helping them, it made the stronger and bigger and more economically prosperous Nigerian state look weak by comparison. But the thing is, these trips were necessary because for better or for worse, Boko Haram is already an international crisis, and Nigeria needs Niger and Chad to help, and they need to maintain good relations with all these countries. At the same time, the so-called Francophone cluster that's around Nigeria is strengthening, especially with the French Operation Barkhane in the Sahel. So it's necessary to remain on positive terms with these countries and rebuild the Lake Chad region. Also, Lake Chad is supposedly very rich in oil reserves, so by having good relations with the neighbors, it can hopefully preempt any forthcoming territorial disputes in the aftermath of Boko Haram. Now, looking at the G7, Mr. Buhari is one of only a couple African leaders that came to the meeting, and he asked for development assistance, security, and health assistance. Some of this is for power and infrastructure, foreign direct investment, but what's most important is that he was asking for help against Boko Haram. No details were released, but this could possibly mean that he's looking for training, equipment, supplies, and maybe intelligence assistance as well. Before, the West didn't want to help Good Luck Jonathan, the previous leader of Nigeria, because they placed political conditions upon him, just as they did upon former Prime Minister of Iraq, Maliki, in his help against ISIL. The thing is, they wanted to isolate both leaders, and they didn't mind, they as in the West, didn't mind if the terror groups grew stronger as a result, so long as they were able to indirectly achieve their political change. But with Mr. Buhari, he's seen as being a fresh start for Nigeria in the West, so that's why he came to Germany to ask for assistance. He's also embracing his neighbors as part of his new strategy against Boko Haram, but he needs to be careful, because an integrated, internationalized struggle, yes, it could help defeat Boko Haram, but the question is, what comes after? And could Nigeria ever fully reestablish its sovereignty in northeast Nigeria after the conflict is done? That's the big question everybody's wondering right now. Third on our countdown is the gargantuan corruption scandal in Guatemala, which has seen major government officials humiliated and has brought thousands of protesters to the street seeking the president's resignation. Now, Mr. Otto Perez Molina, he is the pro-U.S. leader, he's the president, and he's worked in the 1980s with the military government. He's also a former military head, and he's linked to some pretty messy extrajudicial killings from the Civil War period. To go back to the current conflict, though, what has occurred is there was major corruption revelations in the beginning of April, and these created a cascade of more revelations throughout May that led to tens of thousands of people coming out of the street and many government resignations. For example, Vice President, gone. Health Minister, gone. Environmental Minister, gone. Secretary to the President, gone. They've all resigned or been arrested because of corruption. And the protesters say they want to have the president leave office as well. Well, here's some context about Guatemala. It's basically ruled by what some people call dynastic oligarchy, meaning that around 40 families, by some counts, control almost all the wealth, land, and even the drug trade in the country. Well, this all was further embedded in the country's fabric because of the over 30-year-long civil war that occurred from 1960 to 1996. In the course of events, genocide actually occurred, and over 150,000 people were killed, 80% or so of which were Mayans. Now, anyhow, before this, the whole reason this occurred is the U.S. carried out a coup in 1954 against the leftist-leaning leader, President Jacobo Arbenz, who was thought to be a communist, supposedly, and this created the situation that led to the civil war, that led to the poverty, that led to the dynastic oligarchy becoming even more entrenched. So, guys, why does it all matter? Why does anyone care about what's happening in Guatemala? Well, it comes down to U.S. designs for Central America. First thing, there's this Alliance for Prosperity in the Northern Triangle. This is the name of the plan between Guatemala, Honduras, and El Salvador to stabilize the northern area of Central America, just south of Mexico, to prevent all the illegal migrants from crossing over, to get rid of the drug trade, and just to create some economic prosperity. Well, if there's a change in leadership, there might be a change in objectives. And instead of looking towards cooperation with the U.S., a potential forthcoming Guatemalan leader might look towards BRICS or even Brazil. We don't know, but we do know there could be a different type of government because the protesters are pretty leftist. The current president is right-wing. Of course, there's a dichotomy there, and the U.S. is always against any left-wing movements in the Western Hemisphere. Another thing is that the U.S. wants to integrate Central America with NAFTA. This is part of the U.S. strategy of engagement with Central America that they published online before. Well, the thing is, as I mentioned, if Guatemala shifts its priorities, this is going to affect integration with Honduras and El Salvador. And Honduras also has their own anti-corruption protest right now, so we might be seeing a regional effect here. So guys, this is a story no one's really been talking about, but it's actually very important, and everyone should know about it. Our runner-up is the terrorist attack in India's northeastern state of Manipur and how it endangers the fragile ethnic balance in the distant region. What had happened is 18 soldiers were killed by ethnic terrorists. Now, this group is called the National Socialist Council of Nagaland, Hopling, and it wants a greater Nagaland, which they call Nagalim in northeastern India and parts of Myanmar. Supposedly, they have about 3,000 fighters. They attacked Manipur State, and they also want to create a larger Nagaland, as I said, either within India or as a separate state, but they want to change its internal boundaries and have some separatism. Well, Naga migration outside of the home state of Nagaland has created some troubles in the so-called Seven Sisters, which is the name of the northeastern Indian states colloquially, and these terrorists are based in Myanmar, in areas that the government doesn't fully control. So what we have here, because they became cross-border with their attacks, internationalization of both Myanmar and northeastern India's conflicts. And we just see what had happened earlier this week. India intervened in Myanmar in a secret operation and killed 100 of the terrorists. So now we see India actually showing that it's resolute with its war on terror. But this might inevitably destabilize Myanmar even more, because right now there's a very fragile truce between the government and the plethora of ethnic separatists fighting against it. And something else that I want to talk about here is that this Naga group wasn't just acting independently. They're part of a larger separatist umbrella, the third one in recent years, called the United National Liberation Front of West Southeast Asia. Yeah, it's a mouthful. But technically, they function as a type of ISIL in the sense that they have a unifying ideology. Basically, all ethnic groups fight against the Indian state in order to become independent. Second thing is, they're secular and left-wing, so they also have even a deeper layer of similar ideology, if you will. Next thing is, they're very unconventional, just like ISIL, and they're international, just like ISIL. They're taking advantage of very porous and, if you will, uncontrolled borders. Just like ISIL is between Syria and Iraq, this group is between India and Myanmar. Sure, there's a lot more stability in Southeast Asia than there is in the heart of the Mideast right now, but still, I think the point is valid. Also, you have disparate groups teaming up to take down the government, as I mentioned, and they're going cross-border, and they're committing terrorism. They're just not yet blowing themselves up. So we see this larger phenomenon of umbrella groups, in this case in Southeast Asia, uniting, committing terrorism to carry out their larger vision. In the Mideast, it's of a caliphate. In Northeast Asia, it's of a hodgepodge and smattering of these semi-autonomous independent states. No one knows what comes afterward. They just know what they want to get. And now that India has actually involved itself in Myanmar's mess, the question is, where does it go from here? And nobody really knows, but it's going to be one of India's most important issues in the coming years. How to stabilize Myanmar, how to get rid of separatism and the Seven Sisters. At our top spot, we've got the surprise defeat that the Turkish people handed down to Erdogan and what the results really mean for the country's future. Guys, this was really bad for Erdogan, this election, because it basically put the brakes, perhaps indefinitely, on his plan to change the constitution and increase presidential power, which in this case would have been his power. His party, the AK party, only won 40% of the vote. But it was somewhat unexpected. But why? Why did this happen? Well, guys, I think the answer is in Syria, because the latest string of scandals show Turkish intelligence smuggling weapons to Syria. Well, the only groups that control northern Syria, aside from the government, are hardcore Islamist groups. And Turks, as pious as they are, do not support Islamic extremism. They don't support what their government's doing there. And this might have been the straw that broke the camel's back and made them vote against Erdogan. But let's see how everyone else scored with the votes, just so we get an idea of where Turkey could be headed. Well, the main opposition, the Republican People's Party, got 25% of the vote. And they're against Erdogan. They're against what's happening in Syria. And they're actually part of Atatürk's party. Atatürk, he is the founding father of the modern Turkish state. So there's an historical political party here that was fighting against the new political party, Erdogan's AK party, that only came to power in 2002. Next party, the Nationalist Movement Party. They got 16% of the vote. They're hardcore far right. And their unofficial street wing is called the Grey Wolves. They've been linked to violence, bombings, and assassinations from the 1970s onward. And actually, in Kazakhstan, they're labeled as a terrorist group. If the AK party forms a coalition with them, which the nationalist movement says they're not interested in right now, it could make Erdogan even more aggressive, not only against Syria, but also against people inside his own country. And I'm talking about the Kurds. And this brings me to the next party. The HDP, or the People's Democratic Party, is seen as pro-Kurdish. It's very far left, absolute opposite of the Nationalist Movement Party. And in terms of social issues, they're very secular, and they actually go pretty far in being pro-homosexual, and they talk about transgender rights and all those types of things. They're seen as being similar to Greece's Syriza. Well, they historically passed the 10% threshold needed to have a parliamentary seat before they were just fielding their candidates independently. By being part of the Turkish parliament as Kurds, now they can actually show that the Kurds have a voice in the government officially, but all their support is in the Kurdish area, showing that their far-left politics doesn't seem to really be penetrating to the rest of Turkey. But the big question is, guys, as Kurdistan rises in Turkey and Iraq, as we're seeing, what does it mean for Syria's Kurds? Can it have an even more destabilizing influence on them? And what's going to happen in Turkey? Is Erdogan going to form a coalition? If so, with who? Will there be early elections? What's even going on in Turkey? Do the Turks even know? Guys, these are really troubling questions in what was supposedly one of the most stable countries of the Mideast until now. All right, everybody, this brings an end to this week's very exciting episode of Context Countdown. Thank you so much for listening to my show, and I hope you'll tune in again next week. Take care. Bye.